ladies and gentlemen. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. Thank you so much for tuning in today. As always, a pleasure having you with us, and I hope you're all doing well today. Today we have a new guest on the show, Parse the Noise, a new YouTube channel that I came across here just actually a week or so ago. I was doing some research on the Dinesh D'Souza film, and this is one of the videos that actually came up. Of course, I immediately went and looked at some of his other videos as well, including one on the demographic situation in Ireland. Very, very interesting. So welcome, Parse the Noise. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. So before we dive into some of the topics, a lot of things have been happening, especially, of course, in the British Isles. There are places in the West right now that are literally burning, including Gothenburg in Sweden. We might touch on that later, too. But for the viewers that don't know about your videos, when did you start the YouTube channel?
The channel has been going for roughly a year now, and the majority of videos on there are about demographics and migration to an extent, and the general changing shape of the global population.
And what are some of the topics that you became interested in and that kind of spurred you to feel that you needed to start a YouTube channel and kind of wanted to produce some of the stuff on your own?
So I'm in the middle of a series of videos about are titled Population Transformation, the first of which was about the changing population in the third world, specifically, particularly Africa. And what's happening there is there's been an enormous population explosion. And what's often left out from the debates on migration and multiculturalism, etc., is that explosion is fueling the migration. So I thought a necessary bit of information to get in there into this debate about migration was just how large the population change has been in the third world, especially Africa, especially other migrant-sending countries.
Yeah, and pointing out, too, of course, that it's us in the West who largely have, it is us who have contributed to this in terms of aid, resources, in some cases. I won't deny that we haven't been, in some cases, a destabilizing force, but in many other situations, we have been a stabilizing force and not just, you know, gone in and supported, one dictator and handed them all the weapons or something like that. There's a lot of illegal weapons trade going on into the third world and stuff like that by corrupt governments. I remember even one of the UK guys, the Miliband brother, was actually charged, I think, a while back for running, you know, weapons and stuff like that into certain parts of Africa. So that certainly happens. But my point being, Parse, is that we have certainly contributed to the coming wave that probably is going to try to pour into every country in the West when there is a colony collapse in Africa and potentially even Asia.
I think so. I think there's definitely going to be massive and long-term ramifications that will indeed impact on us in the West. And but you're right about although there is a role that the West plays in destabilizing many of these countries with military intervention and so on. I looked in that first video I mentioned, I looked specifically at numbers that were arriving in Italy and Greece last year during the migrant crisis. And I looked at the top countries that the migrants were coming from, and the common denominator wasn't really conflict or war. It was population growth. All of them have had populations that have doubled in the last 20, 30 years, which is pretty incredible, especially when you compare it to the fact that, for example, France, Germany, Britain, their populations have only really doubled over a span of 120-something years. Of course, we had the New World, Australia, New Zealand, and America to give our excess population to, but it nonetheless is a notable factor in the migration we're seeing to the West at the moment.
Absolutely. This is an incredibly interesting area, and I think we should definitely dive into this here a little bit later in the show. One thing I actually wanted to start with, if you don't mind, is some of the recent developments that have happened in the UK. I wanted to get your comment, of course, on the car that actually plowed into Parliament. One man is in custody already. They are saying that they're treating this as terrorism. What do you know about this?
I don't know very much about this at the moment. There aren't many details that have been released. What we do know so far is that the individual is Sudanese, but also a British citizen, and he's believed to have been living in Birmingham, in the Hall Green constituency, I believe, which is known for being very vibrant, shall we say.
Yeah.
Very, yeah. So quite a segregated community in which there's a long history of breeding radicalism and of other terror suspects and terror, people who do terrorism coming from there. The gentleman that ran at, I think it was the Buckingham Palace with a knife last year, he was also living in Birmingham and had connections to the same area. There have been plots on plots to murder Tommy Robinson by people that have lived in the exact same area. So it's a recurring pattern in this area, in this community, if you like.
That's interesting. You know, we had, of course, the Islamic mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. Many people pulled out the line, rightly so. He said it was part and parcel of living in a major city these days, which is a very interesting way of looking at a very, very, you know, just unbelievable situation where all of a sudden Britain, who's never had this kind of level of terrorism before, it just starts popping up in unison, of course, with the diversification, shall we say, of the country. But you shared with me before we started an interesting idea, and I totally agree with you on this, but bring up our viewers to speed on this in terms of why you think that these things are happening and why some of these people who are coming in to the West and to Britain, we open our arms, most people do anyway, most countries, they open our arms to these people, we let them in, we're charitable, we give them, you know, more than they could ever dream of to a certain extent, but yet they turn on us. Why is that, do you think?
Well, one thing that's often not mentioned is that many of the people who get involved in terror plots and act out terror plots, they come from relatively stable, often middle-class backgrounds, and although there is a certain religion that is more correlated with this, they often are not growing up in a radical environment. They later on in life find radicalism. Some of them are converts whole, out of whole cloth, but many of them, probably a good number of them, are finding radicalism despite a more moderate upbringing. And I think that part of that is because it's a radical Islam provides a sense of identity in a very alienated, deracinated world. I think modernity is something that none of us are really adapted to be in. I don't think multiculturalism is a particularly functional way to run a society. I think it breeds resentment. And I think the only sort of thing that we're all supposed to integrate into is consumerism and social media and an entirely vapid, vain existence. And I think that many of these people who turn to radical Islam are revolting against that. They're in search of a more meaningful identity, a more authentic identity. And I think there are, I think that plays out across the board. I think that whichever race you look at, they're not all going towards terrorism or radical religion, of course. But even if you look at the fellow that's been dubbed Sky King, if we look at his backstory, he seems to be a very alienated individual. A person who didn't fit into modernity in the way that we are supposed to. And the manner in which he ended his life and was very radical, but it was also similar to what we see with radical Muslims, an attempt to define himself in a way that transcends the ordinary and the banal.
He ended, of course, with a barrel loop. I'm trying to find the footage of that right now. And it was interesting because he seemed like such a kind of a happy guy to a certain extent. You know, when he had that conversation with the airline traffic controller, you wouldn't suspect that he would do something like this. And, of course, the line that stood out is the one where he was kind of asking, you know, would I get a job? Like, or the controller said, like, well, you can, you know, if you can pull this off, I'm sure you can get a job doing anything. And he's like, nah, I'm a white guy, right? So he knew on some level what it was that was going on, if you will. And it's a tragic story, and it's kind of a haunting saga as well, to a certain extent, of a guy who just kind of all of a sudden, I don't know, hopelessness or it clicks or something switched in him, and he realized what really was going on. It's very, I don't know, many people connected with the story, you know what I mean?
Yeah, people really did connect with the story, and it went beyond the usual kind of ironic shitposty way that people connect with,
right?
For example, the YouTube shooter or, you know, other people who flip out and do radical things. There's a certain, like you said, a tragic beauty in what he did. The line that stuck out for me was when he was talking about how beautiful the mountains looked, I think you mentioned that more than once.
Yep. Olympics, or whatever they call the chain up in Seattle, Washington there.
Yeah. And it sort of, it has kind of Nietzschean echoes in a way, the sense of, ascending the mountain and finding beauty in nature and, you know, the solitary act of overcoming one's mediocrity in a way. It's something about it resonates with people, but I think it's a reflection of the fact that, as I said, I think we're all pretty much alienated from modernity. I think it's a dysfunctional civilization that does not particularly foster healthy individuals.
Absolutely not, exactly. And of course, this is the big key, you know, that you mentioned right now, talking about why then some of these. I mean, in this case, this guy even admitted, well, I didn't even know I would do something like this. I guess I have a screw loose. But he didn't want to hurt anybody. He, I don't know if he intentionally crashed the plane where he did, but he was concerned with this aspect of it, that a lot of people will be disappointed at what I'm doing and stuff like that. But I think he knew enough. Obviously, he did a barrel roll, so he did it, knew enough to take the plane down where he wanted to, which was outside of any, you know, civilization, so to speak. While then, on the other hand, you have the terrorism in London, of course, where it is about, when they can do it, hurting as many people as possible. So there's a quite big distinction about how a white guy goes out versus a Muslim, right?
I would say so, yes. I think the distinction perhaps is not racial so much as religious, not to, kind of take a Dinesh D'Souza kind of way out of it. But like, I think it's the very fact that Islam promises a hereafter, whereas for most white people in the West, we are spiritless, I suppose. We are atheistic. We are devoid of religion, basically. So there's no hereafter. There's only the grand gestures you can do within your own life and your own time.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk a bit here about, in terms of the developments in London, of course, because they continue with, there was a ton of knife attacks as well that has ramped up. And as we said, in Birmingham, crime has gone up a lot. There's a lot of issues there. London, of course, too. We posted an article here about Birmingham, calling it London 2.0. Crime has been soaring as white British become a minority. So this is what we can expect in terms of the future parts. You know, if we look at like the projections and stuff like that, in terms of the demographics, and this is, of course, why we are so concerned with these questions, that our societies is radically transforming and changing itself, and we are the ones who are starting to feel like outsiders in our own countries. And this feeling, this alienation, is, I think, not only tragic, it is actually from the mainstream's point of view, from the established culture's point of view, something that actually is scary, because it will create individuals that basically feel like they have nothing left to lose, right? You know, what I'm saying is, in a way, is that the establishment is kind of, they're doing this towards themselves, and they're bringing this on, because there's certainly enough studies that point in this direction, like Putnam's studies talking about this aspect, that people get alienated, the lack of meaning and everything kind of disappears from their life, right?
That's certainly the case, and it's certainly the case that as the demographics change in the West, then so too will the society. More than just on a level of crime, on a level of culture, of course, as well, and in ways that none of us have really been given a chance to debate or discuss. I'm sure, as we're all aware, discussion of these things, no matter how sober and rational one approaches it, it always is met with allegations of racism or bigotry, xenophobia, etc. So I think it's important to, part of why I'm doing what I'm doing is because I want to inform as much as possible the debate with sound data and rational arguments calmly presented. I know that the vast majority of people are not particularly interested in that, but the vast majority of people are not particularly interested in looking up from their smartphone. So I realize that I'm tailoring my work for a particular kind of audience. But unless we do try and steer the conversation back towards sober, rational, fact-based, honest discussion, then the polarization that we're seeing in our society will only increase, and terrible events will only more certainly unfurl.
Yeah, I think in some cases society has chosen to use the tragedies as kind of a social glue, that this is actually one time you see these alienated communities and those who are just sticking to their own. Actually, they do. It's shallow, so don't get me wrong, but it is an opportunity for them to come together to a certain extent, even if it's very fake and whatnot. But it's hardly ever focused on the tragedy or even the lives lost. It's a dedication to how, it, almost in a perverse kind of way, wonderful it is that people can come together in such a horrible time, right? And they turn it into a festival of love and things like this. You know, you've seen it all over. In Stockholm, we had this after the major terrorist attacks. There were no real dedications to the victim, the young girl who had her body maimed by this truck that was used as a weapon. And so I've said, you know, this has actually become a tool for the establishment and for the elite that, it's kind of self-reinforcing, if you know what I mean, that when the terrorism happens, they can do these events after them that kind of feels this artificial, you know, closeness of people. They're brought together for a little while, and then after a while, it trickles away again. And that's why multiculturalism demands new sacrifices on its altar all the time, so that this artificial temporary glue can come in place and kind of let these groups connect, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I certainly agree. One event like that that sticks in my mind was after the bomb in Manchester, and people from Manchester came together in the middle of the city and started singing an Oasis song, Don't Look Back in Anger, this Gen X anthem of disinterest, and this band that really represented nothing but hedonism and, you know, pleasuring oneself. I thought it was a fitting anthem, really, and it sort of shows that the only thing modern people can sort of come together on is mutual disinterest, mutual apathy.
It's so bizarre watching this, and you know, you sent me a couple of links as well of some of the stories. We'll get into more detail, and one of them had to do with medical. Is it the Frontier? What are they called? The Doctors Without Borders? Is that what they're called?
Yes,
MSF.
Yes.
Yeah, Ireland. Their faction. And it's interesting because this has also kind of become the new religion to a certain extent, where the most emotion and well-being that people have in the deracinated modern world is to actually engage in refugee collection, I guess you could call it, of bringing more people into the West, right? That these people get a sense of self-gratification, they help others, they can bring them to whether it's Ireland or Sweden or Germany, and these groups can show how good they are, and then they can also kind of reinforce this whole pattern that we've been talking about. But tell us about this video in particular. We can take a look at it in a moment.
So what this video is of, it's an aid worker who works on the now infamous boat, the Aquarius, which is run by Médecins Sans Frontières, and it is currently operating in the Mediterranean. And what they do in the Mediterranean is they rescue migrants close to the Libyan border, and instead of returning them to the Libyan border, they bring them to Europe. And people may recall a few months ago, Salvini, the new Italian interior minister, I believe, very vocally told the Aquarius they could not dock in Italy anymore, and that Italy would not be taking any more of these migrants, because there have been many, many, many boats docking on Italian shores and Greek shores, and now also Spanish shores, delivering these migrants from quite often from sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East and all these regions that have explosive population growth. And in this video, this woman explains that the majority of people who were on this boat are from Eritrea and Somalia, which is in the Horn of Africa, which has been enduring persistent famines and droughts and environmental problems for years now. Both countries have had their populations double within, I think, approximately 35 years, and both are in regions that have serious problems with droughts, as I said, but also desertification, soil erosion. So essentially, due to the presence of too many people and modern industrial farming methods, these regions are becoming uninhabitable in a way. And this is precipitating the movement of people into the West. And this is something that's not often mentioned in this debate about migration.
Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. It's, you know, we think we help, you know, people in on location, if you will. But it is interesting that it's driving it. And this has to be, you know, one of the more difficult questions that we are faced with, to be honest, because, you know, if we just speak outside of the realm of, you know, what we should do and all that kind of stuff, we know that, you know, the currently human nature is, of course, to help others, especially we Westerners. We're very warm-hearted. We want to help other people. We want to make sure they you know, have a good life and all that kind of stuff. And we share what we have and stuff like that. But it's then a self-reinforced, it's a feedback loop, I guess we can call it, where to a certain extent, the more good that we try to do in the long term, the more damage we are going to do. It's, as they say, of course, the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, right? That's really what we're looking at here.
For sure. I think one thing that the left does actually get right about its general worldview, I think, is that the left tends to counter the nationalism of the right by saying a lot of the problems that we face, such as the environmental ones, are global, and parochial nationalism and retreating into ourselves will not help us fix these problems. I think that's one thing that they do get right. But you're right that they approach these things emotionally, and that we've approached these things collectively as a society in a very emotional and non-methodical manner. If we throw food aid at these places, then they will be fine. What happens when you throw food aid at places like the Horn of Africa, then you have these population explosions. There is a positive correlation between countries that are in receipt of massive food aid and this population growth. And the more the population grows, the worse the environment becomes, and the more people will have to move in order to live, to sustain themselves. So we have this term, economic migrant, as a sort of a way to describe a lot of these migrants, but it's really not a very accurate way of describing things, I think. Quite often they're environmental migrants.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, it could be argued that that's what we saw during the migration age as well. If you go back to before, I don't know how much you know about, you know, that particular piece of history, but it was one of the more settling times in if not even in the world, definitely on the European continent, where you had all these floods, I believe, of the Danish mainland. Some of them that's connected to the continent, not some of the islands, going down into northern Germany, which left, of course, the Cimbrian, the Teutons to actually uproot. And I think you had over a million people, more or less, picking up and leaving, marching down to Rome. And we know what happened then. It was a tremendous chaotic period and upheaval. And to a certain extent, I think we can expect to see something similar. We're starting to see the effects of that now, of course. But now we have, as you say, not only environmental, it is war as well that's driving this, and they're using war as an excuse. If it was only Syrians, yeah, maybe that would have been one thing. But, you know, they're coming from countries which don't even have war. Many of them are even sub-Saharan Africa. And many of those countries are fine. These are, as you say, economic refugees, and they flee because they can't just, you know, they can't make a life for themselves in the region they're at, you know?
I think that's true, but it's also worth pointing out that the regions in which there has been conflict, the scarcity of food, the scarcity of fresh water is a massive factor. In the Arab Spring, it's often cited that a big factor that precipitated that was food shortages, and similarly in Syria, lack of access to fresh water is often cited as a factor for driving that place to conflict. So certainly what the West does in terms of its foreign policy and what its security services do in these places, and the religious fundamentalism of certain people in these places, keeps the conflict going and to a large extent pushes it into being. It's also, if we are honest with ourselves, we can't ignore the fact that environmental issues are also at the heart of it. But I think the response that we're supposed to have to it has already been decided for us by our politicians in many ways. A lot of our leaders see the low fertility of our own countries and have decided that the way to address that is by bringing in people from the third world. But what they sort of often leave out is that many of these people are low skilled in their own countries. And when they come here, they're not in a position to either work at all, or more likely they would work in low-paid industries, which benefits big business, of course. But in reality, they're often not even paying taxes because they're earning too little. So the argument which is put forward by our leaders that this is good for the pensions and for the healthcare systems, that they'll pay into it, is not true.
No.
Nonetheless, there was I think it was Macron recently said that the destinies of Europe and Africa in the coming century will be linked, and that many, many, many millions will be coming to the West, which makes you wonder who gave him the right to decide that and not let us have a say on it.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, we actually posted one story here. Let's pull it up real quick. Macron endorses the Kalergi plan. 200 million Africans to mass migrate to Europe within 30 years. I mean, that's just unbelievable. That is unbelievable. We can't even imagine that. It's right now we're, what, over 500 million? It would be almost half would arrive within 30 years. That's, if there's anything that's unsustainable, it would be that, you know?
For sure. One thing in another one of my videos titled The Death of the West that I point out is that even the numbers we have for people who we believe want to migrate, I believe a majority of whom want to come to the West, numbers that we have for that are likely to be a very low bar estimate, basically. So the potential for close to 1 billion people, if not more than that, to want to migrate, everyone who in this research who expressed an interest in migrating, if they actually did get up and migrate, then we're talking about close to 1 billion people, if not more than that, migrating around the world, which is, as you said, it's the only sort of comparison we have for that is the age of migrations when the Roman Empire was entirely wiped out, the Huns came into Europe, the Goths and the Vandals came down from Scandinavia, and it entirely reshaped the continent of Europe and its culture. That is what we're facing again.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, before we go too far, let's just check out that video before we forget it with the Doctors Without Borders and see what she has to say. Let's check that out.
We performed these two rescues under the coordination of the Libyan authorities 3 days ago. These people deserve to be disembarked in a port of safety as soon as possible. And this is according to international law, to the Refugee Convention, that people, after being rescued, should be disembarked in the closest port of safety. Over the past few days, we've been very busy doing medical consultations and also identifying any people with extra vulnerabilities. And already, out of all of the people that we have identified as having additional vulnerabilities, more than 50% of these are already highly vulnerable. They're unaccompanied minors. They have been treated the same as the adults in Libya. We're hearing desperate and complex stories about the minors being sold, resold, being optioned, being enslaved, being in enforced labour. We've heard desperate stories about how they were tortured, and they've been extorted from, their families have been extorted from massive amounts of money, between 8,000 and 25,000 US dollars over the period of time that they were in Libya. So maybe they were sold by one smuggler or a trafficker for a certain amount of money, then they were sold to somebody else again. So they've been sold and extorted several times on their journey. These are persons of concern. A vast majority of people on board are from Somalia and Eritrea, and they have had a very difficult journey. I heard a story from one miner who began his journey at 14. He's now 16 and has suffered just desperately in this time, has been tortured and has been sold many times. He's safe now on board with us, but he deserves to be in a safe place. He deserves to be on land where all of their needs can be met and where they can receive the additional supports that they need now that we can't offer them here on board.
All right, so let's talk a bit about this, because obviously what the Aquarius and other ships too, even military ships in some cases, have been doing is that they literally go down to the Mediterranean and pick these boats up, which of course is destined to begin with to fail. The traffickers don't even put enough fuel in. They know this stuff. You're not, by maritime law, you're not allowed to leave a ship stranded, right? So they have to pick them up. But let's talk about this a little bit of what she's saying here in terms of that they you know, according to the refugee rules or whatever laws, they have to go to the nearest port that is, you know, in a safe country or whatever. But they are bringing them to, you know, as I'm saying, you know, countries that are further away from where they came from and stuff like that in some cases. And they're literally, we've seen the maps. I'll see if I can pull some of these up here in a little bit. But they're going literally between like Africa and Malta and Spain and Italy and just like, you know, pouring these people over time and time again. There has to be something here which is like they are violating some kind of rule or some convention. If they aren't, they should be, and there should be some law in place. How do you look at this, like Aquarius and some of these other ships involved in this?
Ships like the Aquarius are well aware of what they're doing. They, as you say, they're hanging out very close to the Libyan border, and they're picking up boats that very deliberately are not intending to complete the journey. This is one way they found of getting around certain types of flows that were coming in, flows of people that were coming in a couple of years ago. By rescuing them, you sort of have no choice but to accept them. So they are playing the rules to their advantage, for sure. It's often never really, the story she told is very sad, and it's, you know, pulls on your heartstrings. Well, if you want, what then? How many more are coming? And how does this
exactly
fix the problems in the society that they're coming from?
Yeah.
How does this fix the problems that are in Libya? How does this address the problems of people trafficking and the torturing of people that are trafficked and all the horrible things that are happening to them? As long as you're facilitating these migrants into Europe, and as long as they know they can get across, then the numbers will continue. The people traffickers will continue. The torture will continue. The Libya as a failed state will continue to be a failed state.
Yep, absolutely. You're completely right. And this is what's so aggravating, of course, with the whole deal as well, because they, as you said, they know what they're doing. They're definitely in a situation where they want to make sure that this continues to happen. But encouraging this kind of behavior must be that there's no one who's recognizing that this is the worst that they can do. That only means that this is the intended consequence. This is the policy, if you will, of the EU. I think one of the prime guys, Peter Sutherland, of course, out of Ireland, were one of these guys who were the head of the refugee I forget exactly what it was called in the UN, the Refugee Council or whatever the hell it was called. And he saw this as the task at hand, right? They're saying, we got to welcome these people because we're not, you know, there's not enough people in the West and stuff like that, which shows them that they are happy with the situation to a certain extent. They are intending to bring as many people as they can to the West without thinking of any of the consequences of what this is going to do to social cohesion, what it's going to do to society. And as we've already seen, this has been a complete disaster so far. And if these people are going to continue to come, how will our countries look in 10, 15, 20 years from now? Is it going to be, I don't know, a war zone? What do you think is, what's the projection here? What do you see if you look down the line a bit?
Well, before I go into that, you're certainly right that this is part of the EU's policy, even if it's to a degree an unstated policy. And you mentioned previously that there are military boats in the Mediterranean that are bringing people in a similar manner to the Aquarius and other NGO boats. Well, in my video about demographics in Ireland, I mentioned the fact that the Irish Navy are in the Mediterranean ferrying people in the same manner. And they're there as part of Operation Sophia, which is a EU operation that ostensibly is intended to dampen the numbers and discourage migrants. But I believe it was a study by the UK's House of Lords found that it had the exact opposite effect. It had only encouraged the people traffickers and encouraged greater numbers of migrants to come to Europe to make the hazardous journey. But it's there certainly is an attitude amongst our political elites that this is not only inevitable but desirable. Diversity is a strength, of course, so why would more diversity be a problem? And there certainly is an element of the political establishment that believes this is an answer to the aging populations of Europe. But the people like Peter Sutherland are especially creepy, to be honest. You don't have to believe in a grand conspiracy of the New World Order to see that this was not a pleasant gentleman who had very little regard for the average European and what they thought of their enrichment.
Absolutely, it's absolutely horrendous what's happening, and it is a crime. It is a crime against us and our coming generations and the world that they will have to grow up in. And the fact that all of this is being done outside of the realm of what the people actually think. It's not democratically enforced. This is brought upon us by unelected bureaucrats in many cases, especially from the EU. But I want to continue talking about this And then a little bit later in the show, I want to see if you got any, or in the second part, I want to see if you had any takes on what's happening in Gothenburg. Same thing's happening there now in terms of the violence and the upheaval and stuff like that. Tons of fires, like 40 cars or something like that was lit here last night. And it's just chaos in so many different regions. And then we could talk a bit about Dinesh D'Souza and see what some of the conservatives' answer to some of these problems are. But before we take a break and continue in the second segment, just quickly tell our audience again about the YouTube channel where they can find your stuff. I know that you're on Twitter as well. How often do you usually put out videos? Just give us a little bit more about the work that you do.
Yeah, so the videos are on a channel called Parse the Noise, P-A-R-S-E-T-H-E-N-O-I-S-E. You can find that on YouTube. You can also find that on BitChute. I have an account on Twitter, the same name. I have an account on Minds, but I'm not particularly active on there, so don't expect too much there.
Check that out, folks. Go to YouTube.com. Check out Parse the Noise. A lot of good videos. I certainly haven't seen them all yet, but I intend to go through the backlog, the archives. A lot of good stuff there. A lot of research. And the one about global population, definitely make sure that you take a look at that one. Super important material. It isn't touched upon that much, but it's very, very important. So, yeah, we'll take just a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to continue with the second part together with Parse the Noise in the members section. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll see you on the other side.